headed to the home stretch in quarter number four on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Welcome back. It's quarter number four of the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's Ask Greg time. I'm Dustin Hockensmith. I'll be firing questions at our own Greg Pickle here. These are questions for you guys submitted through the Keystone Sports app. If you don't have it, go get it. There's an Ask Greg button. You fire off a question. Greg answers it on the air. If he deems your question the best of that particular show, you get a bottle of tailgate wine from tailgatewine.com. They got some great blue-white themed wines, an 1855 Vidal, Sapphire Blue, which is a blueberry wine, Old Main Pinot Grigio. You can check them out at tailgatewine.com. You can also ask a really good question of Greg here and perhaps win a bottle of tailgate wine from tailgatewine.com. We are going to get started. There's some good sort of big picture questions that came in, Greg. And if we go back to – certainly back to when Penn State took off in 2016, There hasn't really been a time – to question and to wonder about the big picture of the program better than it is right now. We've spent a lot of time talking about it this week, the past few weeks, really, and coming off even a win over Indiana, we're still talking about it. So it's good timing for these. Let's start with John from Defiance, Ohio. Says, I don't think the loss to Ohio State hurts our recruiting at all. It was a great environment and a close game. How bad does the Michigan State loss hurt recruiting? Do you agree that Penn State lost to Michigan State due to coaching as much as anything?
Yeah, a couple things on that. Number one, it really a lot of people are going to try and draw this conclusion now because Aaron Young, the Coatesville running back, committed to Michigan State 2 weeks after Michigan State beat Penn State. I don't think he was necessarily going to ever wind up at Penn State to begin with, to be real honest with people. I think that Michigan State, I think he was a little bit upset that Penn State took so long to offer and other schools like Michigan State came into the race. I think Rutgers led for him in the Crystal Ball, but that Michigan State was always one of the teams that were a very possible school he could end up at.
So. When a real program offers, then they take precedent.
Right. Nicely done. I know everyone wants to make a lot of people want to believe that each loss has its own impact on recruiting. It just really isn't the case. Now, where it does start to add up is when you go 8-4, 9-3, etc. But if you 11-2, 10-2, whatever, 10-3 even, you know, you can still sell that moving forward. So, no, I don't think so. Did they lose to – was it the Michigan State game because of coaching? Was that the second part of the question?
Yeah.
Man, I guess. I have such a hard time balancing it from time to time. What is the responsibility of the coaches on game day? And you know, we always expect the coaches to save the players, but we never expect the players to save the coaches. I mean, at some point, Ricky Ronnie, James Franklin, the entire staff has taken a whole heck of a lot of heat, less heat, if a couple passes here or there are caught, a couple blitzes here or there are completed and it turned into a sack. I mean, can you make the argument that the coaching can be better? Certainly, but so can the execution.
I don't think that's a question at all. And really, we've been trying to figure out what exactly the intersection is between coaching mistakes and player mistakes. And the coaches aren't out there dropping the balls, but are the coaches in practice not doing the right things to fix the drops issue? They're not moving the ball in the four-minute offense, but is it a play-calling issue or is it an execution issue? Or is it some combination thereof?
So one thing I want to say on that is, you know, these guys didn't get to Penn State because they were dropping footballs in high school or because they didn't know how to catch. And David Corley didn't come in and sit down and say, all right, guys, I'm going to teach you a way to catch the ball that doesn't allow you to usually catch it. I'm going to teach you a way that consistently makes you drop it. That didn't happen. But I think what did happen is you look at the depth of routes and you look at the way guys finish their route, and that's where I think you're starting to see a lack of crispness and a lack of completeness. That can very easily be put on David Corley. I mean, again, the players are the ones out there running the routes, but you know, if that continues to show up over and over again, I think that is something you can evaluate David Corley on. But drop passes, again, I mean, at some point David Corley can't go out there and catch him. The guys on the field have to catch him. So that's my little side rant about that.
I recognize the challenge, I think, because it ends up being physical and mental when a guy, it's just not happening for him, and how do you as a coach try to fix that on the fly? It hasn't been fixed yet, so I'm not sure if David Corley has the answer to that either. Ryan from East Berlin wonders what happens first. Justin Shorter makes an impact, or Micah Parsons puts his hand in the dirt and rushes the passer.
Ooh. That if so Justin
Do well, either of them happen?
Well, I mean, I think that's sort of an unfair question. It's a good question, but I think it's a little unfair only because Justin Shorter, to make an impact, is going to have to see an uptick in snaps, whereas Brent Pry could make a small sub-package adjustment to put Mike at the defensive end spot just once for the sake of doing it, and that would win that conversation. So I think it's more likely, though, that Justin Shorter does see a bigger role. But look, he has to earn it in practice. People just want to assume that because he was a five-star, and look, it's partially my fault, us in the media who write about these guys and hype up their five-star and all the stuff they do in high school, and his tape was awesome and all that, but he's developing a little bit slower than I think most people expected. And at the end of the day, he has to earn the snaps. I mean, you can make the argument that Penn State should replace some of its receivers because they're not performing well, but at the end of the day, the guys have to show in practice they can do it in the game. I don't know if he's doing that right now or if he's just a little bit behind because of the time he missed with the injury, but either way, I guess I'd probably yield towards Parsons just because he's going to say, like I said before, he has to start seeing more snaps.
And I think that's going to happen. I also think that he can rush the pass. I don't care if his hand's in the dirt or not. I don't care if it's a two-point stance or a three-point stance. I want to see him in a position to rush off the edge.
Yeah.
And we just haven't – how many times do you think we've seen that? Once or twice maybe?
Yeah.
It hasn't happened much.
Yeah, there's a lot Penn State needs. And that's the other thing, too. You know, what'd they have? 6 or 7 sacks? I have the stats here. I can tell you.
I'm pretty sure it was just Shaka Toney and Yetur Gross-Matos.
Yeah, 6 sacks. You're exactly right. 4 and 2 from those guys. 8 tackles for loss. I mean, but the pass rush was non-existent a lot of this game. And I get that Indiana had a concerted effort to get the ball out quickly, but there were no hands in passing lanes. There were a few times when either Peyton Ramsey or Michael Penix, seemed to feel discomfort of any kind or pass rush of any kind. One of the worst statistics in college football is quarterback hurries, but Penn State was credited with just one. Now, their own stat people may have had a few more, but wasn't many more.
It's drops and pressure, something to look for going forward. Good question from Ryan. Chad from Jacksonville, Alabama. With Joe Moorhead as offensive coordinator, it seemed he called plays based on the personnel the defense had on the field and tried to find mismatches in coverage. You think Ricky Ronnie calls the game the same way?
Well, yeah. I mean,
he tries to.
Is
that not the end goal for every offensive coordinator?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think that's been something that's been brought up a lot this week and last week, too, is that Ricky Ronnie is somehow not calling the game like an offensive coordinator is supposed to call the game. That's not the case. He just doesn't always pick the right play call, or the things on the field aren't done the way they're supposed to be done, so it looks worse on him than maybe it should. Either way, obviously, there's a lot of frustration. I thought that there were parts of his conference call with reporters before the Indiana game that just didn't jive with what we were seeing on the field. He had this vibe about him that, you know, more or less, hey, it's football. Sometimes things happen. And that's true, but there's also things that you do that make bad things happen. And it feels like Penn State from time to time is doing those things far too often. So, yeah, I don't know, Dustin. I mean, is he calling the game the way that he should be? I mean, I think more often than not, yes, but there's still times it feels like he's a first-year offensive coordinator and there's growing pains to come along with those.
And I think that's exactly right. And I think the question, it's worth asking. You don't have a optimal feel or instinct for anticipation of what opposing defenses are going to do yet. And you fall into this rut maybe of not reacting to what they're doing as quickly as they're reacting to what you're doing. And I think that if you would suggest that about Ricky Ronnie, I think that would be fair. The question is, how much of that is an experience thing? How much of that is an acumen thing? You do have what amounts to a very inexperienced play caller here in his first full year. I think it's different. He called a great, great game plan against Washington in the Fiesta Bowl. I think that's different than calling it week in, week out, dealing with the ebbs and flows, dealing with the adversity, worried about the long term and player development and all that stuff. He's just kind of in the mud right now of being a coordinator for the first time. I will be curious to see if some of the stuff starts to change. And certainly, if guys aren't catching passes and you're off schedule, you can take some responsibility for being off schedule. But if you're off schedule because guys aren't making plays, it makes your life and your job as a play caller all the more difficult. And that's where Penn State's been too often behind behind schedule from just physical errors.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's the thing where it's hard to, again, you go back and forth here. Is it the chicken or the egg? Is it the player or the coach? The coach only has so many play calls they're going to work on second and 10, third and 8, third and 11, second and, you know, 7. At some point, you can make the argument that Penn State's calls on first down maybe put it in that kind of situation. But the other part of that, the conversation too, is that Penn State execution on the field sometimes puts it in that situation. There's only so much you can do.
This is Ask Greg on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by tailgatewine.com. Another couple questions I think we have time for. Stan from Nashville. It's an interesting, fair question. How could so many of you analysts be dead wrong on Penn State, Michigan State and the game prediction? Looks like no one, he reiterates, no one saw that one coming. What accounts for this? Is it groupthink run awry? I sometimes get concerned about that we all have like-minded. I mean, maybe it's our backgrounds. Maybe it's the way that we've seen things, but there was nothing. I know this is supposed to be a question for you, but I decided to answer it first. There was nothing on paper that suggested that on Penn State's home turf, Michigan State was a real contender to win that game. And I guess in hindsight, in retrospect, you can go back and be like, you know what? The personality of that Michigan State program, the coaching matchup, Mark D'Antonio versus James Franklin, maybe we should have seen that difficulty coming, but we didn't. And Michigan State, they were not a good football team on paper at all. So I don't really, you know, I take ownership, I guess, of picking that game wrong. But
I do too. But I'll tell you what, I'll tell you what. If you told me before that game that I could either give away half of my paycheck for the rest of my life or get double my paycheck for the rest of my life, yeah, and
or $28,
and all Penn State had to do was win, I would have happily entered that agreement. I would have entered it twice. I mean, there was nothing on paper coming into that game that told me that Penn State off a bye, with Michigan State coming in off a pretty ugly game with a matchup with Michigan on deck, was going to find a way to not just come into Beaver Stadium and beat Penn State, but pretty much control a lot of that game. So maybe it is group thing, maybe it's not, but good luck finding anybody that was on the right side of that one that had a pick out before the game.
There were not many. There weren't many who picked Michigan State to cover, let alone win the game outright.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to the coaching matchup, I think we said it last week, Michigan State changed their entire blocking scheme to prepare for this matchup. Who is able to do that on the fly from one week to the next? They made a lot of changes to get Brian Lewerke outside the pocket. So what you saw from Michigan State to that point in the season, they threw out the window because they changed everything. Best question, Greg.
Let's go with the Ricky Ronnie one that was from the last question before this one. So I can't remember who asked it, but we'll go with him.
Chad from Jacksonville, Alabama, about Moorhead calling plays versus Ricky Ronnie calling plays. Yep. There you go. You're the winner of a bottle of tailgate wine. We'll be in touch. Chad from Alabama, here on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Thanks for tuning in. We are moving on. We are moving on to next week here on the Keystone Kickoff Show.
Labatt Blue and Labatt Blue Light want to remind you that fall is the best season. Why? Because of football. Leaves. Fantasy football. Flannel. Beards. Tailgating. Oh yeah, and more football. Welcome to the best season ever. Grab some Labatt Blue and Labatt Blue Light. Because it's time to get undomesticated. Beer. Labatt USA, Buffalo, New York. Always enjoy responsibly.
Life gets complicated. And it only gets more complicated when things change. Which is why AAA insurance agents take the time to talk with you. So that they can help you choose the best auto and home coverage. Don't put off getting protected. Let AAA help cover what you care about. Insurance that's not just insurance. Talk to your local AAA insurance agent or visit AAA.com to learn more about AAA.
409 Tailgate Club proudly introduces our tailgate wines. Like our great sauces and rubs, you'll enjoy our wines at your next cookout, tailgate, or even as a great gift for that fan of the blue and white. Speaking of blue and white, you've got to try our award-winning Sapphire Blue, made from pure blueberry juice. Or how about our Old Main Pinot Grigio and 1855 Vidal? Go to tailgatewine.com and find all our PA preferred wines. That's tailgatewine.com.